Right. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to our BIPS webinar series for the autumn term, Excavating the Archives, David Sronach's Fieldwork in Iran with the British Institute of Persian Studies with Gareth Brereton. A brief introduction for Gareth. Dr. Gareth Brereton is the British Institute of Persian Studies Sronach Fellow at the University of York here in the UK. There he is researching the David Sronach Archive. Prior to this role, Gareth was curator at the British Museum, responsible for the Mesopotamia collections. He was lead curator for the British Museum exhibition, I Am Ashurbanipal, King of the World, King of Assyria, and the UK touring exhibition, Ancient Iraq, New Discoveries. He also co-curated an exhibition on Assyrian palace sculpture with the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Gareth previously was a curator for the Ur of the Chaldees project, aimed to digitally reunify the archaeological material and archival resources from Sir Leonard Woolley's excavations at the ancient city of Ur. His main research field is the funerary architecture, archaeology and material culture of the ancient Near East. He has conducted archaeological research and field work in Iraq, Oman, Turkey, and Greece, and including the British Museum's recent excavation at Tello in southern Iraq.
Thank you, Andrew. So good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us. So today I'm going to talk about my current research on the David Sronach Archives, which contains a wealth of material related to David's early fieldwork in Iran with the British Institute of Persian Studies. So David was a leading figure in the field of Iranian archaeology, and he was founding director of the British Institute of Persian Studies, and he left us with an extensive archive of his pioneering excavations in Iran. Currently, they are held and being digitized in UCLA in California. The digitized files are then sent to the UK to be reviewed and catalogued by myself, with the eventual aim of making the digitized archive freely available online via a BIPS-hosted website. Importantly, it is anticipated that the archive will also be used to generate new research and scholarly publications. So in March this year, in 2023, I traveled to UCLA in California, where I was kindly hosted by Dr. Ali Mousavi to begin sorting through the wealth of archival material currently held in his office. So my task during this initial visit was to examine and organize the archival material in preparation for digitization and cataloging. And from this preliminary review, it was evident that the archive contained extensive documentation relating to David's early excavations with BIPs at the archaeological sites of Yaram Tepe, Pasargadae, Nushijan, and Shari Kumus, a summary of which will be presented in this evening's talk. To begin with, however, I'd first like to provide a brief overview of David's early work in Iran and the founding of the British Institute of Persian Studies. David's first encounter with the ancient world came from a visit to the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, following his evacuation from Britain to Canada during the Second World War. From this formative experience, the nine-year-old David declared that he wanted to become an archaeologist. Having studied archaeology and anthropology at St. John's College in Cambridge, David's first experience in fieldwork in the Middle East was in 1954, when he joined the British Academy's excavations at the Great Palace of Constantinople in Istanbul, which was then under the direction of David Talbot Rice. Upon graduating, David received scholarships from the British Institute of Archaeology in Ankara and the British School of Archaeology in Iraq. And with his scholarships, he spent the next 5 years excavating in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, alongside some of the leading British archaeologists working in the region, such as Seton Lloyd, James Mallet, and Sir Mortimer Wheeler. And in this picture from the archive, you can see David and Mortimer at excavations in Pakistan. Notably, between 1957 and 1960, David worked under Sir Max Malouin at the Assyrian capital of Nimrud in northern Iraq, where, in addition to assisting Agatha Christie on her frequent shopping expedition to the bazaar, he was responsible for recording and publishing the metalwork. In 1960, David also directed rescue excavations at the Ubaid prehistoric site of Ras al-Amir in southern Iraq, where the settlement mound had been cut and damaged by modern canals. And this was David's first experience of directing an archaeological excavation. It was in Nimrud, however, that the idea of establishing a research institute in Iran was mooted, and David was appointed as the British Academy's archaeological attaché at the embassy in Tehran to lay the groundwork. So the idea of creating an institute in Iran started there. Plans for the new research institute were approved by the Iranian authorities and officially opened as the British Institute of Persian Studies in December 1961, with David as its first director. In 1976, the institute finally moved into a purpose-built premises in Tehran, which now holds an extensive library and other resources for researchers, and is open to Iranian students, scholars, and members of the public. So here you can see from these images from David's archive, David's receiving his OBE for services to British cultural interests and Anglo-Iranian relations from the Queen Mother during her official visit to Iran in 1975. I mean, I'm not certain, but from these images, I assume this either took place at the Institute itself or perhaps at the British Embassy. David served as the British Institute of Persian Studies founding director from 1961 up until 1979. And during this time, David directed excavations at the sites of Yarem Tepe, Pasargadi, Nushijan, and Shari Gumis, which, as we will see, form the basis of his extensive archive. In 1960, during his appointment as the British Academy's archaeological attaché in Tehran, David directed excavations at the mound of Yarem Tepe. So this site is located on the Gorgan Plain, one of the most fertile regions of northeastern Iran, which at the time was relatively unexplored by archaeologists. The mound itself is relatively small, rising some 20 meters above the surrounding plain, and it's situated on the bank of the Karasu River, which, as you can see from this image, has cut into the north face of the mound. This cut from the river effectively provided a natural section from the top of the mound down to virgin soil, which is what initially attracted David to the site. So in the course of just two seasons, in 1960 and 1962, it was possible for David and his team in a short space of time to delineate an archaeological sequence that spanned the late Neolithic through to the Iron Age. Now, one of the main aims of this excavation was to outline a pottery sequence for the site and to collect carbon-14 samples, which would help establish a regional chronology for the Gorgan Plain. Unfortunately, however, the results of the excavations remain largely unpublished. Only two brief summary reports were made available in the public realm. Luckily, upon my review of the Stronach archive, however, it was immediately evident that it contained much of the original field notebooks, finds, and pottery registers, drawings, plans, and also some photographs of the excavations in progress. So being that the site was so poorly published originally, and that the quantity of archival material was manageable, being that it only contained two seasons worth of documents, it was decided that Yarem Tepe archive should be prioritized for digitization. And the aim then is to prepare a final report on the excavations, which is the focus of my current research. So at Yarem Tepe, a total of 10 trenches were cut into the mound, four of which were cut into the side of that mound that was eroded away by the river. So you can see in the top left corner then the cut in the mound and some of the trenches starting to be excavated. One of the trenches was laid out on the mound surface so you can investigate the top layers of occupation, and three were placed on the lower slopes with an overlap in the hope of retrieving a complete archaeological sequence down to virgin soil. And so in a short space of time from these levels, from these trenches, a total of 33 levels were observed at Yarem Tepe, but these are occupation levels, spanning five broad archaeological phases, covering the Neolithic, Chalcolithic, Bronze Age, Iron Age, and Parthian period. So the archaeological sequence at the site starts approximately 1 meter below the present level of the plain, where David and his team exposed the remains of a Neolithic village. And amongst the assemblages there, he found crudely painted straw-tempered pottery, which is comparable to ceramic assemblages from the so-called Jaten culture, where the sites are mainly in Turkmenistan. And from this, it can roughly be dated to around the 6th millennium BC. So that's the earliest levels at the site. Following a break in occupation spanning some 1500 years, the site was then reoccupied in the Chalcolithic period, as excavations revealed houses built from large bricks with human burials made below the house floors. Pottery types from this phase included redware vessel forms decorated with black paint, which are directly comparable to that recorded from a nearby site called Shah Tepe, level 3, and that suggests the date between 3200 and 2900 BC. Interestingly, the sequence from the Chalcolithic to the Bronze Age is unbroken at Yaram Tepe, with a well-documented transition from plano-convex to flat mud bricks used in house construction, a notable increase in metal objects, and the introduction of fine pattern burnished grey wares identical to those known from a site called Tepe Hisar in levels 3b, suggesting a date between 2200 and 1800 BC. Following a second substantial break in occupation, the mound was resettled in the Iron Age, the earliest level of which can be dated to around 1100 BC. Due to substantial pitting in the site, that's people digging pits into the mound, that had cut into much of the Iron Age occupation, so very few architectural details were recovered. Nevertheless, the perimeter of the late Iron Age settlement was crowned by a massive wall of flat mud bricks, which suggests that the mound functioned as a citadel in this later phase. Finally, the later levels at the summit of the mound revealed four levels with distinctive fine redware bowls, which are decorated with black edge flame-like patterns, and these can be attributed roughly to the brief Parthian phase of occupation at the mound. And then from then on, the mound was abandoned. So this was David's first excavation. In between his field seasons at Yaram Tepe, David started another major fieldwork project at Pisargadi, the grand capital of Cyrus the Great. The remains of the site were surveyed and excavated over three field seasons between 1961 and 1963, the results of which significantly advanced our understanding of this important Achaemenid city. Compared with Yaram Tepe, David's excavations at Pisargadi are well published, most notably in a substantial final report of 1978, which remains the standard work on the site. The archival material of Pisargadi, however, includes about 1,000 slides, and these document the progress of the excavations and also the condition of the standing architecture at this time. These images have now been digitized and already catalogued, and they will form the first corpus from the archive to be made fully available online in the near future, or hopefully near future. So David's excavations at Pisargadi focused primarily on a mound of Tali Takht, which featured a monumental stone platform located on the western edge of this natural hill that was evidently constructed during the reign of Cyrus the Great. The platform is 80 meters in length and 15 meters in height, and is made of some 20 courses of massive stone blocks, each of which weighed up to 6 tons. Excavations at this platform showed that it comprised an outer and inner wall with loose central core filled with rubble. Two monumental terrace staircases were uncovered during the course of the excavations, neither of which, however, were ever completed. So it seems the platform was constructed to support a monumental building complex, perhaps a palace, but the project was evidently abandoned for reasons that remain unknown. At a later date, probably during the reign of Darius the Great, a monumental mud brick structure was erected on the stone terrace and across the adjoining hilltop. And the revised building plans now used mud brick exclusively, no stone. At the western edge of the Tali Takht, directly above the earlier stone platform, stood a central complex of rooms and open courts, industrial installations, and also a strong outer wall, which was designed to be part of the mound's defensive system. And this fortification system extended across the adjoining hilltop and comprised a series of monumental towers linked by a massive perimeter wall. In addition to the excavations at Tali Takht, David and his team conducted a detailed architectural survey and partial excavation of the standing remains of Pisargadi, including such monuments as the tomb of Cyrus the Great, the sacred precinct, the palace area, and the royal garden complex. At the sacred precinct, David completed the excavation of two limestone plinths, some 9 meters apart, that were located on the western end of the enclosure. The two plinths are constructed in white limestone and stand on a large stone foundation that reaches up to over 2 meters in height. It has been suggested that the function of the southern plinth, which was fronted by a staircase, as you can see in this image, served as a platform from which the king could worship before a portable fire altar, which would originally have surmounted the adjacent northern plinth. And a similar scene is depicted on the funerary relief of Darius the Great, which you can see in the bottom right of the slide. Over the course of the survey and the excavations of Pisagadi, David revealed evidence for part of the design of the royal garden, which was fortunately preserved in the form of water channels and basins that covered a length of over 1,000 meters. The garden took the forms of two adjacent adjoining rectangles in front of the main facade of Palace P, that's one of the palaces at the site, while two portico pavilions stood at least at the east and the south corner of the garden. It was during the course of the excavations on Pavilion B that David and his team found a water jar that was buried below the surface. And within the water jar, it contained a hoard of well-preserved jewelry and precious objects, evidently hidden during the last days of the empire. Larger pieces from this hoard included a pair of gold bracelets with ibex-headed terminals, three pairs of gold earrings, silver spoons with zoomorph handles, and multiple elements from several different necklaces. So this was quite an incredible find. Following his work at Pisagadi, David's next major project in Iran was the excavation of a well-preserved Median period site on the Malaya plain called Nush-i-Jam. The site of Nush-i-Jam was identified during a survey of the region conducted by David and T. Kyler Young in 1965, when the pair came across a prominent rocky outcrop, the summit of which was covered by crumbled mud brick deposits with pottery dating to the 7th century BC. So this looked like a promising site. And excavations at Nush-i-Jam began in 1967 with David acting again as director. The site itself, which is located on the fertile Malaya Plain, proved to be an important Median and Parthian period settlement, which was excavated over five field seasons between 1967 and 1977. The site is relatively well published and includes three preliminary reports published in Iran and two significant monographs covering the architectural remains of the Median period, as well as the small finds. However, planned volumes on the Median pottery, the later Parthian settlement, and the related survey of the surrounding plain remain to be published. Therefore, in terms of research and publication potential, the extensive archive for Nush-i-Jam, which again includes the original field notebooks, registers, drawings, plans, and photographs of the site, is of great importance and should be prioritized for digitization with a view to publication. To date, over 500 negatives documenting the excavations and finds have been digitized, alongside a number of field books and registers. Much, however, remains to be done. So Tepe Nush-i-Jam is located some 60 kilometers south of Hamadan, in the flat alluvial Malaya Plain in the central Zagros range of western Iran. The mound itself, which rises to a maximum height of 36 meters above the surrounding plain, is natural, and the various structures were built atop a high, rocky shale outcrop. Over five seasons of excavations, a remarkable series of buildings and a perimeter wall dating to the Median period were discovered at Nush-i-Jam. The buildings themselves were remarkably well preserved, with walls that stood many meters high with features such as doorways, windows, and even ceilings left intact. And this state of preservation was due to the fact that the buildings were carefully filled with stone and mud brick before being abandoned. And then a short-lived squatter settlement occupied the ruins. Following that, the site was resettled briefly again when a Parthian village was established on the mound. So in terms of the Median buildings, the remains of a central temple, or the so-called central temple at Nush-i-Jam, was uncovered in 1967 at the central point of the mound and also at the highest point of the site as a whole. So it was clearly an important building. The mud brick walls of the building were built directly upon the natural rock outcrop of the hill, And the temple plan itself is unusual, being that it takes the shape of a stepped lozenge. Despite its architectural complexity, the building is relatively modest in size, measuring as it does some 16 meters from east to west and 16 meters from north to south. While its original height is unknown, the remains of the structure actually stood some 8 meters in height, and it is believed that the original roofline may have approached a height of some 10 meters. The temple is aligned roughly north-south with a single entrance in the middle of the south wall. So on entering the temple, a narrow corridor led to an antechamber from which doorways on the west led to a spiral ramp, which itself provided access to a room above and presumably also the roof, but of course the roof did not survive. The room above the antechamber then led to a tall, spacious chamber that served as the temple's sanctuary. This room, the plan of which took the form of a stepped triangle, evidently rose to the full height of the building. To the northwest of the entrance was a substantial inverted stepped altar, which dominated the floor space in the western half of the room, while a series of niches and recesses decorated the stepped wall surfaces of the sanctuary. Notably, a mud brick fireball with a thickly plastered burnt surface was found on top of the altar. The remarkable preservation of this building was the result of its careful infilling with enormous quantities of shale, and particular care was actually taken to protect the altar and decorative niches using mud brick packing. After filling the rooms, the entire building was capped with several courses of mud brick, demonstrating the careful ritual closure of the temple before its abandonment. Following the construction of the central temple, a substantial fort was erected on the mound. The fort stands on top of a mud brick platform, is rectangular in plan, and is formed of massive buttressed and recessed outer walls some 2 meters thick, which were constructed from mud brick and mortar. Like the central temple, the fort is remarkably well preserved, with the upper walls standing in places up to a height of 7 meters, complete with defensive arrow slots. It is probable that the fort originally had a roofed upper story of overshadowing the central temple and making it the tallest structure on the mound. The interior ground plan of the fort comprises a guard room with adjoining ramp and staircase, as well as four long parallel magazines, in one of which was found a remarkable hoard of silver ingots and scrapped silver jewelry. The long narrow magazine rooms may have functioned as storerooms, perhaps for goods such as grain, oil, wine, raw materials, and military equipment, suggesting that this fortified building was in part used to secure and manage accumulated goods from the surrounding region. The columned hall at Nushijan was probably the latest of the major Median buildings to be constructed on the site, and it was excavated by David and his team over the course of all 5 seasons. The hall was similarly built upon a mud brick platform, but it has an irregular plan, being that it was partially constructed against existing structures. Nevertheless, the north, east, and south walls of the columned hall are essentially freestanding and buttressed. The inner faces of these walls were plastered and originally whitewashed and further embellished with a series of decorative step niches set about 2 meters from the floor. The roof of the hall was originally supported by 12 wooden columns arranged in 4 rows of 3, as demonstrated by the preserved column bases and surrounds that were set into the floor. So I think in the bottom left picture, you can perhaps see the column bases there. Unlike the central temple and the fort, the columned hall's function could not readily be determined from the architectural remains and associated finds. The excavation of this building, however, further revealed the presence of a tunnel that cut into the floor, which penetrated deep into the natural bedrock of the hill. Now, the entrance to this tunnel comprised a ramp that went down through the mud brick platform, and the tunnel itself was then cut into the bedrock at a 30-degree angle for a length of around 25 meters. Before, for some reason, work was seemingly abandoned. From the stratigraphy, it appears that the tunnel was probably contemporary with the occupation of the columned hall. Its function, however, does remain a mystery. Its practical use as a water supply, underground storeroom, or tomb is unlikely, and is also unlikely that the tunnel was used to mine shale for the filling operation of the buildings during their abandonment. So while the architectural remains and small finds of the Median occupation at Nushijan are well published, It is hoped that the archival material available can generate new research on the Median pottery, the later Parthian village, and the related archaeological survey of the surrounding plain. Between 1967 and 1978, David also worked jointly with Dr. John Hansman at the Parthian period site of Shari Kumis, which is located near Damgan in northeastern Iran. Now, the excavation results for this site are published in a series of preliminary reports and also in a more recent paper on the Parthian pottery from one of the buildings at Kumis. However, a final report has yet to be published, and only short reports exist for the final two field seasons. And the Shari Kumis archive is similarly extensive and comprises the original field notebooks, registers, drawings, plans, photographs, as well as pottery statistics. So there's a lot of potential in the archive to publish and generate new research from the site. So Shari Kumis is a large and principally Parthian archaeological site situated near the western edge of the Damgan Plain, that covers an area approximately 7 by 3 kilometers in extent, so a very large sprawling site. An analysis of the pottery and associated Parthian coins suggests that the site was occupied between the second and first half of the first century BC. Notably, the site features a number of large isolated monumental structures, again, mainly of Parthian date, that are reasonably well preserved as the rooms of the structures were intentionally infilled with clay and mud brick prior to abandonment. So over the course of the field seasons that took place between 1967 and 1978, four of the best preserved structures of Parthian date, which were buildings 4, 5, 6, and 7, were excavated to a considerable extent. Each of these four numbered buildings yielded the remains of a single major mud brick structure. So building 4 at the site is located in the northern sector, about a kilometer to the west of building 5. Now the plan of this structure, which takes the form of a stepped lozenge, includes 4 main rooms with extended alcoves, all of which flank a central staircase. The undercroft of the first flight of the staircase also consists of a series of slightly pointed stepped vaults that are remarkably well preserved. So I think you see in the bottom right of the slide, you can see the mud brick vaults that were preserved from the site. Notable architectural features from this building include a small plinth made of plastered mud bricks in room 5, on top of which was found a fire bowl displaying signs of burning. And again, this may suggest that the building functioned as a shrine or a temple. Notably, the structure appears to have been intentionally infilled with lumps of clay prior to its abandonment. And a number of human skulls, other fragments of human bone and animal remains were found mixed in the fill with some of the rooms, which suggests that the building had a secondary funerary use after its main use was over and abandoned. The excavation of Building 5, so this is another isolated mound on the site, started in the second season of 1971 and continued into the remaining two seasons of 1976 and 1978. Like Building 4, which is located approximately a kilometer to the east of Building 5, the structure stands within the northern part of the Parthian settlement. In plan, it consists of a monumental rectangular structure with a protruding bastion at the midpoint of each external wall. Originally, the building had 3 stories and stood to a height of at least 10 meters above the level of the surrounding plain. A narrow entranceway in the southeastern side of the structure led to an entrance hall that provided access to every other part of the building, including ramps leading to the second and third stories. The upper 2 levels of the building shared a somewhat similar core plan with 2 rows of 3 rooms located on each side of a central corridor. The smaller rooms of the second floor were remarkable for the quantity and range of pottery found within them, in addition to a significant number of clay impressions from bezel rings and stamp seals dating to the mid-Parthian period. And the impressed designs found in these clay ceilings include geometric or abstract motifs, animal motifs, and scenes with human figures engaged in worship and in battle. Indeed, the presence of impressed clay ceilings together with a ceramic assemblage that included storage jars strongly suggests that this building was used to store and centrally administer various goods. Situated to the southeast of Building 5, Building 6 was revealed to be an extensive fortified residence of Mid-Parthian date. This monumental structure is rectangular in plan, with a maximum length of 43 metres and a width of 24 metres, so a substantial structure. Protruding towers flank the outer walls of each of the building's four corners and at the midpoint of each long wall. Half of the enclosed area of the building is occupied by an open court, whereas the main structure featured a series of long, narrow vaulted rooms, which likely served as storage magazines. While very few finds besides a scattering of sherds and animal remains were found within the rooms of the structure, the building did contain a rare inscribed Parthian ostracon that records the distribution of wine to named individuals. Finally, Building 7 at Kumis, which was first excavated in 1967, is roughly square in plan and preserved to a height of 7 meters above the level of the plain. The walls of the structure are composed again of mud bricks and is broadly comparable in plan to Building 4, with the stairways situated in two connecting narrow compartments with preserved sections of a stepped vaulted ceiling. Like Building 4, the rooms of Building 7 were intentionally infilled prior to its abandonment. In this case, however, the whole structure was then surrounded by a second external wall. The internal filling of the structure varied from room to room, but it also included homogeneous clay lumps and mud brick filled with human skulls, complete articulated skeletons, and further human remains mixed with a variety of animal bones. The excavation of some rooms revealed the presence of mud brick platforms with traces of burning situated about 2 to 3 meters above the original floor level. And this suggests that the original structure was transformed into a ritual space for the deposition of human remains before being carefully closed and abandoned. So like Yarim Tepe, it is hoped that the material held in the archive for Shari Kumis can be used to generate a final publication of this important Parthian site. To summarize, from my preliminary review of David's archive, it was evident that it contains a wealth of documentation relating to his early excavations with BIPs at the archaeological sites of Yarim Tepe, Pasargadae, Nushijan, and Shari Kumis. Currently, I'm in the process of sorting, digitizing, and transcribing the archive material for the site of Yarim Tepe in preparation for publication. And again, Yarim Tepe was chosen because it was a relatively modest archive covering only two seasons, so I think it would be a good place to start. And the site is very poorly published. Despite the wealth of material to hand, this is proving still to be quite the puzzle, involving the slow but rewarding process of patching together descriptions, sketches, photographs, and notes, some of which are scribbled on the back of envelopes, to build up a picture of the site and the excavations. However, there does appear to be some gaps in the documentation. As is often the case with archaeological excavations, the amount of detail recorded can vary considerably between trenches and their respective supervisors. Some field notebooks feature thorough descriptions of the excavations accompanied by drawings, plans, and levels, while others contain very little in the way of useful information. Also, many of the excavation photographs do not have accompanying captions, the subjects of which must be identified by comparing images with plans, sketches, and field descriptions. The same is true of pottery drawings, which require considerable work before we can start to produce a valuable ceramic sequence for the site. Nevertheless, despite this, much progress is being made and the preliminary results look very promising. And overall, it's hoped that the digitization of this very important archive and its publication, either in print or online, can make for a significant contribution to this field and will provide a fitting tribute to the pioneering work of David Stroner. Thank you very much.
Gareth, that was wonderful, not only in your part, but also the presentation of this material. Begins to give an understanding to the layperson, very much myself, as to the nature and extent of David's work, but also his accomplishments. Can I be the allow myself just to ask one tiny question? In any one of these sites and the material that David accumulated about these sites, is there a sense that he realized something that the information he was coming across, the material with which he was working, shed some new particular light on something in particular, a sort of a eureka moment, as it were?
Maybe not as extreme as a eureka moment, but certainly all the sites that David excavated, the work he did was definitely pioneering. Take Yarem Tepe, for example. Hardly any archaeologists in the region worked on the Gorgon Plain, and he was one of the first to really establish a full sequence from the late Neolithic through to the Iron Age. And I think part of the problem was, and maybe this is why a final publication was never produced, is that there was nothing at the time to compare it with, really. And so perhaps they were at a loss to compare the pottery assemblages, or they were waiting for perhaps more publications to come out with people working in nearby sites. His work at Pasargadae remains sort of the standard work still on the site, and his publication, if anyone has looked at it, it's incredibly comprehensive. And I think also the work at Nushi Jam is perhaps the most important Median period site excavated up until this day, and certainly the best preserved. And so being able to use the archive to generate more research and to publish more material on these sites is very important.
What did the Parthian coins from Shahr Qumis reveal about its history?
Well, first of all, I'm not a coin specialist, but from what I gather from the published reports is that the coins were found in archaeological contexts and were therefore used as a means to date the site, obviously because they're easily dated. So that was the main thing that I picked up from the archive and the publications. But you'll need to ask an expert in Parthian coins to get a better answer, I'm afraid. That's not me.
From Yarem Tepe, do you plan to integrate the sizable assemblage of original finds that were previously stored at BIPS in Tehran, and which I think are now transferred to the National Museum, says the questioner?
In the long term, yes. Ideally, we'd like to collaborate or go out there at some point. I'm not sure if that'll happen in the near future or not, but ideally, yes, we'd like to go back and look at the pottery held there. Luckily, the bulk of the pottery has been drawn and inked and is ready for publication, but I think there are some crates that are in Tehran that have yet to be sorted and looked at and analyzed properly. So yes, ideally, the grand long-term plan would be to bring this all together.
After visiting Nusha John, which he attributed to the Medes, he claimed firmly that the latter were Zoroastrians rather than Mazdians, but that conflicts with the majority of opinions. Do the archives have any correspondence with other scholars about this issue?
So going through the archives, there has been some correspondence which I found and I've looked at, but nothing that deals with this topic. Overall, the archive really does contain the basic field documents and notes from the excavations, you know, the field notebooks, the plans, the pottery drawings, you know, the registers, all the basics that build up the data set of an archaeological excavation. And that is the bulk of the archive. However, saying that, there are still a few boxes with personal material which I've yet to go through in detail. So there's something could come out of that. We might find out some more.
Next question. Stronach worked at a time when Iran's leaders were using the material culture of pre-modern past to construct the modern nation of Iran. Stronach can be identified as a transnational expert, among many others, who was employed in the process of identifying the pre-modern part. So I was wondering if the archives offer any information about the Stronach's relationships with the local leaders and administrators.
Well, that's a tricky one. Again, going through the archives, which I stress again, is mostly field documents from the archaeological excavations. A couple of official documents and permits do pop up, but they're pretty much, I think, from what I gather, standard permits. The photographs, however, David is sometimes photographed alongside various, I assume, local Iranian officials. So once these go online, it'd be good if people could look at them and perhaps identify some of the people involved at the time. That would be very useful. because like I mentioned before, unfortunately, the case with many of the photographs is that they do not contain the captions, or the captions were never made. So it's quite difficult to identify individuals.
In the 1978 report, David published only a few sketch plans of the excavated sectors on the Tacht and a few pictures of the excavation in progress. Supplementary plans or pictures would be of critical importance to better understand what he described in this report. Are there in the archives the field notebooks of David and of the other members of the team? Also, do you know if parts of the archives or of the excavated materials are also stored in the BIPs at Tehran? Finally, how do you plan to publish all this material?
Yeah. Okay, so with Pasargadae, the bulk of material at UCLA in California are the original slides, which show the progress of the excavation. So there's about 1,000 slides that have been digitized and ready to be cataloged, or have been cataloged ready for publication online. But otherwise, there's some field registers. I haven't come across any of the field notebooks at all, but there are a couple of large scale plans that we haven't digitized yet. But from what I gather, of what I've seen, I think they're pretty much ones that are already available in the 1978 final report. So I'm not sure if there's anything that new in the archive, unfortunately. However, we still may find something. But for Pasargadae, it's mostly the slides and a couple of finds registers. Okay. Was there another part of that question I haven't answered? I can't remember.
Let me go back. Archives of field notebooks of David and any other members of the team?
Any other members? No, unfortunately not.
And parts of the archives or of the excavated materials also being stored at BIPs in Tehran?
As far as I know, the bulk of the paper archives were kept with David and then transferred to UCLA. As far as I know, from looking at some of the records in the archive, some objects, pottery, samples, and so forth, I think were then kept in Tehran. But the documents, the paper documents, UCLA.
Next question. Shahra Khomis also produced textiles, many, if not all of which, are in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. I believe some of the notes are there too. But have you come across mention of them in David's field notes and other materials, such as photographs?
Yes, there is some documentation about the textiles, definitely photographs. There are lists, I think, of what have been sent to the museum, and there may actually be a sample in the archive itself as well that we might need to deal with. So there might actually be a Parthian textile sample at UCLA, which we need to get conserved and looked at. Yeah. But the more we go through it, at the moment, apart from Yarantepe, for the other sites, we've just done a folder level sort of what's in the archive to get an idea. And we'll have to go through it properly. And we have to understand this is 20 boxes of material. It's a huge amount of stuff to get through. So it's going to take years before we finally find out everything that's in there.
Were there any Hellenistic materials among the documented findings to shed more light regarding the era?
So the latest occupation at Yarantepe was actually a Islamic cemetery, an early Islamic cemetery, but then below that, it was straight down to Iron Age, no Hellenistic stuff, as far as I'm aware. The same at Nushijan, there was a Parthian village below which was a squatter occupation, and then you're down into Iron Age. So no Hellenistic material. At Shari Kumis, I don't know, because it's a huge site. They only looked at the main mounds, which are isolated. And I think, for example, there have been some new excavations at the site which have come across some early Chalcolithic and prehistoric remains. So the site hasn't been fully surveyed and excavated yet. So we don't know in that case, essentially.
What were the most significant stroke revealing findings of the Pasargadae excavations? To what extent did Stronach add to the knowledge acquired from the previous excavations at the site by Hertzfeld and by Ali Semi?
Well, I think it was the excavation of the Tali Tacht mound, the stone platform, which was originally constructed at the time of Cyrus the Great, but was never completed. And then the later fortification that was built on top of the mound. I mean, that was a very thorough and detailed excavation and documentation of that particular area. So that was a massive contribution. And Also, the survey and partial excavation of the standing remains was very thorough, very well documented, and remains a really good account of the state of the architecture at that time. And if you looked at the 1978 publication, you'd see it's massively comprehensive.
A question here. David was a professor at UC Berkeley. Why did the archive end up at UCLA? I confess a personal interest here because my PhD is from UCLA. So,
right. I think it's because Ali Mousavi took charge of the archive following David's passing. So the archive, I believe, was housed in a sort of workroom that David, or a work building that David constructed in Berkeley. And then it was initially sorted there, piled onto a truck, and there was basically, it had to move from the building, and Ali kindly agreed to take it in his office. And then it was shipped to Ali, and it remains, for the most part, in around 20 or so boxes in Ali's office. So it was just a practical reason for having somewhere to store it temporarily. And then Ali has kindly been digitizing the material as well.
What type of digitization are you dealing with?
It does vary. So it can range from things like scanning notebooks, registers, some of which are hand-drawn, some of which are typed and quite clear, to things like inked pottery drawings, which need to be carefully scanned, as pencil drawings, which need to be carefully scanned, to things like slides, negatives. And we also have some, 16 millimeter film, which I've yet to get processed and digitized, which is on the excavations at Yaren Tepe. So it's quite wide ranging, from paper documents all the way to film. And yeah, so quite a few different methods needed to get these digitized.
Terrific amount of work. Look forward to the material coming out, you know, bit by bit.
Yes, exactly.
Rounding up of the project. I think this is going to be terrific. And it's the sort of thing that BIPS wants to get involved with, you know, more generally as well. This is where things are going, and it's a question of accessibility by more people rather than fewer. So I think it's absolutely terrific. May I thank both, again, Gareth. Thank you very, very much, Gareth. May I thank Sylvia, our technician. Thank you very much, Sylvia. And all the audience here, a very large audience, and also the people who posed questions. Thank you very, very much. And with that, from here in the United Kingdom, about 6:02, I bid you all a fair evening, or a very good afternoon, or a very good night. Thank you now, and we'll see you at the next talk, we hope. Bye-bye now.